I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in this week for Tanzina Vega. Good to have you with us.
Old time Big Ten football. Touchdown, Purdue!
Well, he said, I got to grab it, and he threw out one of the quickest guys in college baseball.
Gets the Pios on the board first. That's the first goal UMass has allowed in the NCAA tournament this year.
College athletics is characterized by many inequalities that are, well, just... Number one, in many of the nation's poorest states, the highest paid public official is the college football coach. South Carolina, Kentucky, and Alabama have some of the highest poverty rates in the nation, and they each have a state university football coach who earned $9 million in 2020.
Ew.
Two, the equipment, resources, and opportunities that colleges supply for their women athletes are routinely inferior to what they supply for men.
Ew.
And finally, number three, the NCAA makes more than $1 billion a year from the labor of college athletes. But those athletes cannot so much as accept gas money from a team booster without fear of committing a career-ending violation.
Damn!
On Monday, the Supreme Court handed down a decision which chips away at this last ew. The Supreme Court unanimously ruled in NCAA versus Alston that the NCAA was violating federal antitrust laws by restricting the education-related benefits that universities and colleges could provide to athletes. And as for the NCAA's claim that limiting compensation was necessary to preserve amateurism in collegiate sports, well, in his concurring opinion, Justice Brett Kavanaugh said, get that on out of here, when he wrote, quote, traditions alone cannot justify the NCAA's decision to build a massive money-raising enterprise on the backs of student athletes who are not fairly compensated. Nowhere else in America can businesses get away with agreeing not to pay their workers a fair market rate on the theory that their product is defined by not paying their workers a fair market rate. Justice Kavanaugh's argument is reminiscent of a similar conclusion made by historian Taylor Branch in his now classic 2011 piece, The Shame of College Sports. Branch wrote, quote, in the era when our college sports first arose, colonial powers were turning the whole world upside down to define their own interests as all-inclusive and benevolent. Just so, the NCAA calls it heinous exploitation to pay college athletes a fair portion of what they earn. So let me just note this for the NCAA. When your actions can be denounced with equal disdain by a justice who is using free market ideals and by a civil rights historian who is drawing on post-colonial discourse, that's strong evidence that you are indeed ew. Here to help us figure out what all this means for the future of college sports is Amira Rose Davis, Assistant Professor of History and African American Studies at Penn State. She's also co-host of Burn It All Down. Amira, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Yeah, happy to be here.
And also joining me is Adam Liptak, who covers the United States Supreme Court for The New York Times. Adam, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be here, Melissa.
So, Adam, can you walk us through the Supreme Court ruling a bit earlier this week and tell us sort of where this came from and what is relevant about this decision?
So this is an antitrust case. And if you think about it, it's a classic antitrust case because the NCAA has a monopoly over the labor of college athletes. And it uses that monopoly power to pay them essentially nothing. A bunch of athletes challenged that in a class action. And a judge in California said, that's right. And I'm going to issue a narrow ruling that at least as to education related benefits, you know, musical instruments, scientific instruments, summer study abroad, graduate tuition, things that are tied and tethered to education, the NCAA cannot tell its member colleges and universities that they can't compete for athletes' labor on that ground. And the Supreme Court upheld that. Now, so that's fairly narrow. The payments we're talking about are education related. But the logic of the decision, and especially a concurring opinion from Justice Brett Kavanaugh, really suggests that the door is open to further challenges that might allow actual direct salary-like payments to these college athletes, some of whom are huge stars, and yet they get nothing from, as you noted, the billions that these sports programs make.
Yeah, indeed, Kavanaugh was pretty explicit that he understood this as a decision meant to eventually sort of topple the way the NCAA constrains what players can earn, for, which, as you've pointed out, is essentially nothing at this point for their college athletics.
Yeah, he comes out swinging. Brett Kavanaugh is a huge sports fan, huge sports fan. And he has thought about this deeply, cares about it deeply. And he just doesn't understand why this business, unlike other businesses, he said, what if all the restaurants got together and said, we're not going to pay our workers because they should do it for the love of food? Or what if all law firms got together and said, we're not going to pay law firm associates because they should do the work for the love of the law? This same kind of thinking, he says, takes place when the NCAA says, well, amateurism is such a great value that it should allow us not to pay the players. So he was having none of it.
Although, just at this moment, it occurs to me there's probably some waitresses like, I do think maybe the $2.15 tip minimum feels like nothing, but we'll do that on another segment. Amira, let's talk a little bit about how athletes themselves are experiencing this decision. I was just looking at the NCAA website and seeing that the NCAA defines itself as a member-led organization dedicated to the well-being and lifelong success of college athletes. And not to, you know, mock that, but I'm wondering if college athletes feel that way about NCAA.
Well, no, we can mock that. When they say they're a member-led institution and they're looking out for people, what they're looking out for is the universities and the college presidents and athletic departments, not the athletes, right? They're going to use the rhetoric of care and protection to over-regulate, to over-restrict, right? And one of the things that this is addressing is those restrictions that are tighter on college athletes than many other students. But the athletes themselves, I mean, first of all, the evidence is in the fact that they brought this case. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, back in 2014, you have both representation with Alston from football, but you also have Justine Hartman, who was a center at Berkeley, who represents Division I basketball, both men's and women's basketball. So you have a lot of energy behind these cases. And then you also have professional players associations of the NBA, the NFL, the WNBA, who also, you know, been applauding this the whole way through. And so it isn't surprising to me that a lot of athletes are seeing this as a net positive, are seeing this as another thing that's kind of chipping away at this kind of situations system as we know it, that they feel is deeply exploitative, and, you know, with good reason. And I think that this feels like a breath. It's not the whole thing. It's not a full exhale, because the NCAA, if nothing else, knows how to reassert itself, knows how to maintain power, knows how to drag its feet to try to figure out how to do that. But I think that, you know, this is a huge indication, right, that going forward, amateurism is up for debate, and that people are not really abiding by these romantic arguments that try to use that as a shield for exploitative labor conditions.
So dig in a little bit for when I say college athletes. I think so many of us immediately go to football, basketball, maybe lacrosse and baseball, like if we've got a kind of expansive notion. But is this going to make any difference, for example, for women's basketball players or field hockey players, for gymnasts or for, you know, the crew team? Where will this matter? Or is this really just a football basketball question?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is a really important thing to kind of parse out. So like I said, women's basketball is including in this. They are not disaggregated from the collective Division I basketball players who brought this. And I think that we get into this situation where we want to say, oh, the Olympic sports or the non-revenue sports, we usually use women's sports or Title IX as the kind of distraction within that. But you've seen from college athletes themselves who are saying, no, like actually, whether we're talking about educational benefits or, of course, name, image, and likeness, which is moving, is a process going on as well, like we stand to benefit from this as well. And those same over-restrictions that happen on college football players happen on other college athletes. And I think that we gravitate to that, of course, because of the massive disparity in revenue. And really, football is its own behemoth. Like, we put basketball in there because of March Madness, but football, I mean, I think they're generating way, 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 way more, multiple millions of dollars more than basketball. So they're really in their own category. And then from there, the same over-restrictions, especially on ed benefits in terms of student athletes who are not able to take paid internships, who might need food, who might need a laptop. These restrictions affect swimmers who might come from impoverished backgrounds and need that as well. And so I think that the more you get the NCAA off of their backs and off of regulation, the better it is for everyone.
Adam, I want to come to you a second on this, because I was so happy to hear you say that what's going on with Kavanaugh in part here is that this is something he's thought about for a long time as someone who cares a lot about sport. Because I have to say, I've been just a little bit surprised that we've seen as many unanimous decisions from the court as we have this time. And I'm wondering, should I not be surprised? Did I just get kind of sucked in by the cable news anxiety of it all? But at some point, I kind of thought, oh no, we're never going to have another unanimous court decision because the justices are so divided.
People misunderstand that, and partly the press, by which I mean, you know, me, is to blame. We do focus on the big 5-4, 6-3 decisions that come out at the end of the term. But for much of the term, the court does try to find consensus. It's unanimous 30% of the time. And this case doesn't really have a political tilt, right? Whether you look at it as a matter of fundamental fairness or whether you look at it as a matter of antitrust law, the justices did not have a hard time at all finding that this is intolerable. So I don't want to undersell the idea that the court is and will be closely divided on politically controversial cases. But it just didn't think this was one of them. And just to repeat myself, 9-0 decisions are not that unusual. About a third of the court's decisions are 9-0, but they tend to be in less significant cases than this one.
So, Mira, I want to go back to that Taylor Branch piece from a decade ago for a moment. He wrote in it, slavery analogies should be used carefully. College athletes are not slaves. Yet, to survey the scene, corporations and universities enriching themselves on the back of uncompensated young men whose status as student athletes deprives them of the right to due process guaranteed by the Constitution is to catch an unmistakable whiff of the plantation, unquote. So I'm wondering the ways in which race may be playing into both the resistance to compensating athletes and also to athletes' own understanding of their experience in college athletics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it would be quite frankly irresponsible to ignore race and the way it's working here. Taylor Branch, I think, quite convincingly argues that one of the reasons it's so hard to move the needle on this is that, you know, people just aren't really caring about the exploitation of Black athletes and this kind of prevailing idea that they're there to entertain. They don't really have labor rights. Why are they complaining? They should be grateful to be in college in the first place, is so prevalent that it has been very hard until really recently to drum up widespread public support, let alone legal support at that. And I think that you see this play out in a number of ways. Here on my campus, Penn State, of course, demographically, Black students make up a very small amount of the student body, but certainly overrepresented on the football team. And so what does it look like to have that team be the cash cow for the athletic department, but also what we've seen in this last year especially? I mean, I think the pandemic has really laid a lot of this bare in ways that we can absolutely not deny. When you're sending students home but keeping the football team, when Oklahoma State coach Mike Gundy is saying these kids are going to be all right if they get COVID, but they need to start playing again to run money through the state. When those things are happening and you're seeing that disparity in terms of who is being asked to risk their health to play, and especially at schools in the Big Ten, where the rest of the student body, the rest of the athletic department even, is not Black, It's really undeniable. And I think that it leads into a perception that athletes, I know at least the college athletes I talk to and work with, have of themselves, that they receive messages that they are only there to play football, that their education is being shortchanged, that the assumption is that that's what they're there for. And so Black students who are not athletes have that same perception on them. So even non-athletes are being asked, what sport do you play? The presumption being the only reason you're at this predominantly white school in the middle of Pennsylvania is if you're contributing, if you're playing a sport and you're making money for the university. And I think that is very, that's a burden to carry that they articulate and talk about a lot.
So, Adam, Professor Davis brings us to this point that, for example, state universities in particular are not only sort of member institutions of the NCAA, they're also institutions of the state themselves. And we know that some states are taking action to circumvent the NCAA's ability to limit how athletes are earning money or getting these, sort of educational contributions. But I'm wondering if the state having those decisions is really any better for the student athletes than the NCAA.
So you raise an important point. There are colleges that are private institutions, which maybe should have more leeway. But if the state is in essence discriminating, that is a constitutional violation. There's also a separate kind of state action being taken in state legislatures, six or seven of them, circumvent the NCAA's power by giving rights directly to student athletes to exploit their names, images, and likenesses to allow them to make money off of their fame. And, some of these athletes are celebrities. And those laws will allow potentially large amounts of money to flow to student athletes. And there's nothing the NCAA can do about that.
So, Amira, let me ask this. Given what we know about, especially for some athletes, football is a really great example. And there's parts of the year, I think, where this is also true for both men's and women's basketball teams. We know that student athlete label may not be quite right. The expectation is putting, first the team. Should colleges be hosting athletics at this level, full stop? Should young people who want to do this kind of athletics, should they be just able to do it and then maybe get a sort of a GI Bill level college scholarship they could then use later? I mean, is the expectation of both being a student and being an athlete at, sort of a professional level reasonable?
Yeah, I mean, not as it currently stands, right? I mean, student athlete, that's a term that was legally used to just try to prevent workers' compensation claims. The entire system that we have now really is not only being challenged left and right and all over the place, but it's outdated. It hasn't accounted for the massive boom in the amount of revenue that's coming in. One of my favorite arguments the NCAA tried to make is this will contribute to an arms race, as if football programs are not already building spas, right, to pad their budgets. And so I definitely think that there's an opportunity here that actually invites us to actually rethink the college structure in general. The NCAA has been very reluctant to do that. As you mentioned, there's six states that are about to pass name, image, and likeness laws that are going to go into effect July 1. And the NCAA has had time to evolve and try to, do anything with this. And they just are so determined to cling to the remnants of a system that has benefited them so much. And I do think that question is a hard one, but it's one to wrestle with. If this is the farm system for professional leagues, if this has been the only option, we've seen certain people step outside of that and challenge this kind of pipeline. But what does it look like to actually rethink the purpose of college athletics? Now, for some people, it really works. And I don't discount that at all. I have many college athletes who say, this worked for me in terms of my education. I taught a 9 a.m. class that was 85% college athletes, all of them coming in from morning lifts, and they were exhausted. That is not prioritizing education, which is why the arguments that the NCAA makes about them getting this education as compensation feel so ridiculous. And everybody knows it.
And because I teach at 3, I never get college athletes. Adam Liptak covers the United States Supreme Court for the New York Times, and Amira Rose Davis is an assistant professor of history and African American studies at Penn State. She's also co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.